The three presentations that I want to do this week are with a focus to the new church year that begins on Sunday, the Advent Jour of Christ. And although tonight's presentation will be freestanding, since it'll be for the community at large and won't presuppose having been in on this one, I'll share a secret with you all who I expect may be here for at least two or three of the presentations, that there is a sense in which they're related. Some of the questions of Advent for me involve, first, who is Christ? There's a sense in which Advent is playing up on the expectation of the coming of Christ. And I think it's good at the beginning, it's good as we begin that adventure to think about who is the Christ that we expect. And that'll really be the question that I want to raise this morning. Then tonight I'll be talking a little bit more about what situation do we expect this Christ to come into. And that's really when I'll be focusing on what, for want of a better term, we might call the politics or the social situation in Southern Africa today. This morning will be a more theological presentation. Tonight will be more secular, historical, political presentation, looking at the desperate situation into which we expect Christ to come. And then on Wednesday morning, we'll look at the meaning of Christ's coming for our life, or the hope of Christ. It seems to me that Advent, and this is particularly true in the texts that'll come, I mean, even in the text last night, but especially in the text on Sunday, this contradiction almost of a desperate situation in which we find ourselves. It seems the end of the world is at hand, and yet the pointing of the prophets and even the gospel lesson to the notion that in the midst of this desperation, we have hope as Christians. And what is the nature of that hope, or the meaning of Christ's coming for my life? That'll be our theme on Wednesday morning. So this morning, who is Christ? And I want to say right off the bat that I don't really believe that my own vision of Christ is any more large or complete or total than any one of the rest of you. So I don't talk this morning on who I think Christ is because I feel well qualified to do so, but only because I think I'm one of the reasons why you asked me to come and be here is that I've seen a side of Christ or a corner of Christ or an arm of Christ that may be unfamiliar to you. And so I come this morning addressing the issue of who is Christ to share my own particular view of Christ, not because I think it's the right one or the total one or anything like that, but because it's one that may be unusual in the context of our common experience and one that I think is increasingly relevant to us. I said at breakfast this morning that the center of the Christian church will soon be Africa. Current projections are that by the year 2000, the center of Christianity will be the continent of Africa, which says a lot for the size and the population of Africa, but also says a lot about the moving of Christ's spirit on a continent where Christ in modern times has not always been introduced in the most productive of fashions. It's important to say, I think, that the Christian church is older in Africa than it is in North America. And there are many, especially from the Coptic church and in places like Ethiopia, who are quick to remind us that white Western missionaries didn't first introduce Christ in Africa. But they certainly played a role in the spreading of the Christian church in Africa. Although others would want to remind us that maybe the Christian church spread in Africa in spite of the role that Western missionaries played, and more because of the workings of the Holy Spirit than because of our own design. And we're going to talk a little bit about that this morning. There's another sense in which this presentation, which I find I always need to do at Holden, and my apologies to those of you who have sat in on it before and who might find some duplication here, I find I always need to early on in my visits to Holden, share a little theology of my own sense of mission, partly as a way of introducing myself and why I do what I do, but also as a way of creating some common terms of reference for us so that we know what we're talking about when we speak of the mission of our mission as Christians. So I'm going to point to the church in Africa. Now, the first thing I should say is for those of you who haven't shared around this fireplace with me before, that I'm very dependent on your help, and I will appreciate it if you interrupt me with questions as we go through this hour. Don't wait for the end of the hour to raise your questions, because you'll never, that won't happen. We'll go right up until probably the last possible minute. So if you have questions, I'll appreciate it if you interrupt me as we go along with those. And that's a way of keeping our discussion on the track of your interests, I find. Now, the Christian church in Africa is not a continuous whole, no more so than it is in North America or anywhere else. And maybe there's a sense in which we need to make a major distinction between the historical churches in Africa and what are called the independent or spiritual churches. This is not true of every African country. I speak now of the continent of Africa from my own experience in southern Africa. And in southern Africa particularly, we find this dichotomy between the historical churches on the one hand and the African independent churches or spiritual churches on the other hand. I'm not going to say too much about the historical churches, because I find that once I start talking about them, I spend too much time, and I don't have enough time left over for the independent churches, which is really more important and what I'm more excited about. But also because there's a sense in which the historical churches, we know them. They are ourselves. If you've ever had a report back from a missionary in Africa, the chances are high, I should think, among this group, that that missionary was a Lutheran, and that he or she is talking about the Lutheran church in Africa, a church that I would classify over here as one of the historical churches. Those denominations operating in Africa that have historical roots in Europe or the United States. Anglicans, Lutherans, Catholics, Presbyterians, Methodists, Congregationalists, Baptists, all the church denominations that we know and that we're familiar with and that operate their churches much as a duplicate to the way we experience the life of the church here. There's a sense in which these historical churches represent a sense of mission on the part of Westerners, that God has given us the gospel and that we're called as a result of this gift which we've received to duplicate it among other people. And that since the gospel as we know it is full and complete and lacking in nothing, or so we believe, there's no reason to make any alterations as we take that gospel and introduce it to another culture, another part of the world. With the resulting confusion, of course, that we've not tended to be too clear about the difference between our faith and our culture, something that a good number of theologians have addressed in a very beautiful, abstract fashion that I commend to you in several of the books present in your library. The issue, the question of what's the difference between our culture and our faith, that has not been clearly understood by modern Western missionary tradition, with the result that we have duplicated both among these historical churches. And they train their ministers in the same way that we do, i.e. 3 years of seminary life and only 1 year of internship. And they organize their congregations in the same way, and much of their church life looks similar. Those are the churches I'm not going to spend so much time talking about this morning, because they're more familiar to us and because I don't think they have as much to teach us, being in some cases almost carbon copies of ourselves. As I'll say more towards the end of this hour, I understand the real onus of Christian mission to be an opportunity to discover Christ as much as to share what we know about Christ. And so there's a sense in which I'm much more attracted to those churches that are different from ourselves because of what there is there for us to discover. The African independent churches, growing at a rapid rate on the continent, are estimated now to be at least as large, if not slightly larger, than the total membership of the historical churches. In the country of South Africa, it's probably about half and half right now. Half of the Christians there are members of the historical churches. The other half adhere to a faith in the centered around a community of the African independent churches. We call them independent because there's a sense in which they are independent from our historical churches. They tend to call themselves spiritual churches. And maybe there's a sense in which that's a good, if not better, name to be using.
What is that? When they say that, give us some content of how they chose that and what that means in their own self-identity.
Well, I think that they feel that that their the cultural gifts of Africa for worship, music and dance and celebration and these sorts of things, something which is basic to the cultural makeup of Africa, and which they would see as being very spiritual. That they are free to... Maynard, can you give me a glass of water? I got something caught in my throat. Next. That they're free to live that spiritual life in their own independent churches, more so than in the historical churches. I taught in an Anglican seminary over here, and I don't know if any of you have had the experience of singing English hymns, but it can be rather dry, even to an American Lutheran, let alone to an African. And in these churches here, they dress the women would dress in black, commonly, and sing these almost monotone English hymns. Not really monotone, but dry, certainly by the standards of African worship. So they would say our spirits are bound and constricted in these historical churches when it comes to worship life, whereas we're free. To be more spiritual in the independent churches. Another example would be healing or community life. Many things. Let's talk more about community and healing a little bit later. First, I think we should... there's always a tendency when someone... to feel threatened by the notion of someone's independence. There was a time in which most of the Christians in Southern Africa, all of them in Southern Africa, were related to Western denominations. And then they broke away from us, and there's a sense in which we might feel threatened by that without some historic look at what brought it about. So just briefly, I want to say that the beginnings of these independent churches about 100 years ago in South Africa really resulted from some inflexible mission policies over here. You know, the idea that German... Lutheran missionaries, whether operating among Native Americans in this country or among Africans in Africa, had the idea that the first thing you did when you went out to do mission work was to teach people the only language that God understands. And all German Lutherans know that that's German. And it was true that German Lutheran missionaries of the Missouri Synod refused to offer information, confirmation or baptism instruction until people first learned how to speak German. Once they got on terms where they could communicate with God, then they were given instruction that led to baptism. That's a sign of confusing our culture and our faith now. And it was some of the inflexibility that caused some Christians to break away and form their own churches. Another example is music. The idea that God likes an organ best or a piano second, and if you don't have either of those, then you just sing with your voices. And you certainly never allow a drum to come into a Christian worship service, because as all good 19th century missionaries know, drums are the musical instruments of the devil. The devil works through drums. I used to have long arguments with some of my Anglican seminary students about whether or not God would find acceptable some of the folk services being currently offered for worship in the United States. And they were convinced that, you know, we had degenerated and had... you know, they were horrified to learn that such things were happening in our churches, drums being brought in. So the whole leadership thing, the idea that white Western missionaries make better leaders than indigenous pastors. Even when there's an indigenous pastor who's been serving for 30 years and the white missionary dies off and needs to be replaced by a 20-year-old graduate from an English seminary. You know, that kind of situation created circumstances whereby the growing number of Christians in Africa felt that they would better serve the interests of the gospel by breaking away from these white-led mission churches and forming their own African independent churches. So much for the historical break. I've already said that today they're very strong and growing, and I'm vibrant part of life in the church in southern Africa and indeed all over the continent. Although you will find countries, Namibia is a good example, or Tanzania another, where you don't find much evidence of the African independent churches. And it's somewhat of a question for people why in a place like Kenya you have such a prolific number of African independent churches, and as soon as you cross the border into Tanzania you find almost none of them. Some people suggest that it's related to the differing mission policies of different denominations. It is the case that denominations in Africa tended to work geographically. You know, the missionaries didn't want to be in too much competition with each other, and so they would get together and agree that the Lutherans are going to work in this area and the Catholics will work over here and so forth and so on. And different denominations had different policies vis-a-vis the indigenization of their churches, and it does appear to be the case that in some churches where black leadership was brought in at an earlier stage, there has been less occurrence of this phenomenon of independency. Namibia, for example, where black leadership came to be strong at a relatively early stage, you don't find much in the way of evidence of the African independent churches in Namibia. In South Africa, where white leadership is still the rule of the day, you find one of the most prolific examples of the independent churches anywhere on the continent. Now, what is so exciting and attractive about their life? I think it was Kathy yesterday over lunch, was, maybe I shouldn't mention the name since I'm likely to misquote her here, but was talking about rediscovering the Christian faith in the sense, and I find this to be true of some of the ethos of Holden, that people come here in a sense eager to rediscover the faith, which some of us think has been perverted a little bit down the mountainside. And I was saying that I thought, I was answering her and saying that I thought what we really needed to do was to go out in the world and to learn a little bit more about how Christianity was being practiced in some other parts of the world, because there was a sense in which it was still alive for them. Some of the values which we felt had been lost are being lived in some of those churches. And two of the best examples I can think of are related to the notion of community and healing. And I'll say a little bit about both of those in the case of the independent churches. The strength of communal life and also the active gifts and ministry of healing which are pursued in the independent churches. Community. In my experience in South Africa, and you know, please understand that I talk about something I've seen because I can't keep quiet about it, because it fills me with so much enthusiasm I can't do otherwise. But I'm painfully aware, and I want to try and communicate to some degree this to you, of my own limitation as far as talking about the independent churches. First of all, they are not a phenomenon to be talked about. They should be experienced. There's a sense in which talking about such a spiritually vibrant movement belittles their importance. And were they here today, they would share with us an experience of worship that I can never share with you. And that would be an introduction to the independent churches. Secondly, I have had the privilege to worship with a few of these churches in a few small corners of Africa. But it is very much a broad movement with a lot of variety scattered all across the continent. And so don't ever quote what I say about the independent church as gospel truth. You know, it is one person's very limited view of what's happening there and offered to you as an encouragement to see what you can learn for yourself about them, not to fill the compartment reserved in your brain for the African independent churches. Don't let it be that, please. Of some of the churches that I saw, the congregation tended to be not much larger than about 30 people, really. Because, and I would question people about that, and the denomination might grow and include several congregations up to about 30 people in size. But they say that they didn't really like a congregation to get much larger than that, because there was a sense in which It was difficult to maintain the close fellowship once their size got much larger than that. And you find that, in a certain sense, to be true even of our own churches. A congregation of 1,000 members, really the sense of community that operates in a huge church like that is at the level of a number of small organizations within the congregation. You know, a Bible class here, or a women's fellowship here, or a men's club here, or something like that. You know, a number of small groups within the congregation that give us a sense of community. And that same principle is carried out at the congregational level among these independent churches. It's unthinkable in an independent church congregation that there would be a death in the congregation without the whole congregation being there at the funeral to support each other in this time of grief, or to support the family in their time of grief. If economic hardship befalls one member of the congregation, the whole congregation will pool their resources and share it with this person who is suddenly faced with hardship. And I offer my savings to that fellow member gladly, knowing that if I ever need those savings, I can go to this same community and they'll help me out if my need is really legitimate. So a tight-knit sense of community. It's often for people who come from the rural areas into the urban areas of South Africa, at least. And that's a migration that, while it's true for people across the continent, is particularly painful for black South Africans, because they're often confined to the rural areas where there's no opportunity for work, or very little opportunity for work. And if they want to earn money, get a job, they have to go off to the city. And they usually have to go alone. They're not allowed to bring their families with them. And so they come off into the city, out of a rural situation where they knew everybody, suddenly dumped in an urban area of high crime and a great deal of anonymity, and they feel lost. And often the way a person becomes a Christian is through that migration to the city, where they feel a loss of community and where they rediscover community in the context of an independent church congregation, where then they find and feel part of a sense of community again. And then at the same time, become familiar with the symbols of the Christian faith. Any questions about the community? You're not, jump in here.
Are the communities or congregations in regional that they just get together and...
Yes. Or it may be, a lot of these churches are related to the, what we might call a messianic factor. The idea that they're centered around some real strong leader who at times will even claim for him or herself messianic qualities. So this strong leader, sometimes a healer, will be responsible for the growth of the congregation, the charisma of the bishop, usually a male, or the healing powers of the healer, usually a female. And there's a kind of checks and balances system that operates between these two. The bishop, who is the titular head and a male, likes to think of himself as kind of the king of the church, yet at the same time he can't afford to step on the toes of the female healer too much, because a lot of the members of that congregation come because they were healed by this healer. And so the two really need each other. In a highly sexist, patriarchal society like Southern Africa, the woman can't really be as successful as she might want to be on her own, although I'm going to show you some pictures of one who has done it virtually on her own. So they kind of need each other. Now, that means that, let's say, those leaders are based in an urban township. In South Africa, you call the town is where the whites live and all the shops are and the paved streets and the fire hydrants and that sort of thing. And then there's one road leads outside of town across the river or across the highway, the main highway through the area, to the black township. So when I say township, I'm talking about an urban black area as opposed to an area where whites live. And in a given township, leaders will of course be better known in that township than they will be in some other parts of the country. Now, when their congregation grows and gets much larger than 30 people, they might say to the assistant minister of this congregation, who is already getting kind of strong and beginning to feel his own oats a little bit. Why don't you take some of these people over on the other side of the township and have your own congregation over there, and some of us will stay here. So the congregation might split, and it'd be regional within a township, or it might grow. I mean, the healer, this old lady who I'll show you pictures of, regularly makes trips around the country, missionary journeys, if you will. And while she goes out and prays and prays for people and people are healed, new congregations get started in different parts of the country. So it's also regional in a more broad geographic sense.
Do the historical churches recognize independent churches as Christian churches, or do they have any interaction with them at all?
And I'm glad you raised that. I forgot to say that they don't. And then I should admit to you that this line, which I've drawn between the two here, would want to be stressed very strongly by Christians over here in the historical churches. Most of these Christians will tell you that these people are pseudo-Christians who have slid back into heathen ways under the guise of Christianity. For example, they're playing the musical instruments of heathen African religion, drums. So they've slid back into their heathen ways. Or they're sacrificing animals in much the same way as happened in the case of traditional African religion. So most of the Christians in the historical churches would not accept my designation of these people as truly Christian. And for example, and therefore, if a minister over here wanted to attend a seminary, and the only seminaries that exist in South Africa are the ones that white Christians overseas have built for their own sister denomination. And if an independent church minister over here wanted to come to the seminary that I was teaching at, he or she would be told, first you must convert to true Christianity. Then you can come to our seminary.
Do the independent churches use scriptures as their authority? Do they have a Christology?
Yep. They're very strongly biblically based. Although, as we know, especially in recent times and encountering the evangelical movement here, there can be different forms of being biblically, of a faith which is biblically based. Now, I would say that independent church ministers know their Bible better than I do in terms of being able to, in terms of reading it, and being able to find just the right passage that they're looking for to preach the sermon that they want to preach today. You know, in terms of being able to find Bible passages to back up what they want to say, they know their Bible better than I do. Now, what I would know that they have less knowledge of is some of the difference between, I mean, the historical differences between the Old Testament and the New Testament, or some of the literary differences between the Gospels and the Epistles, things like that. The stuff that I learned in the course of biblical studies as part of my theological training, I would have access to that they don't, but likewise they read their Bible better than I, you know, much more frequently than I do. And there's a sense in which the Bible speaks for itself, as well as that background.
If your experience is limited, I don't know what you call mine, 2.5 weeks in one country, all over on the left, but it did raise a question about the independent churches and your first point on community. We were with Lutheran missionaries who at least say, and I think they're genuine, that they want to turn over the leadership to the Cameroonian Lutheran Church. They have certainly made steps toward that. In fact, their major fight with the Norwegians is the Norwegians do not let go as much as we, so we were in on that kind of missionary battle. But let me give you one example. They helped train a linguist to take over the translating department. It's been 9 years of that person, the black African, learning the language to take over the translation. Within 1 year, all of the funds were gone after he took over. They understood why. It was not that he was, quote, dishonest. He had some scoundrel relatives who came once he got in charge of the funds, and when they said they needed money, he obviously gave them money. He not only had his own money, he now had thousands of CFA francs to give them. All right, the white missionaries understand that. In fact, I just couldn't believe the one who had spent the 9 years turning this over, whose whole life was going down the tubes and he now moved to Nigeria, wasn't any more angry than he was. I mean, he had great understanding. Does it work better in the independent churches, among 30 people, if you gave up your savings, assuming that when you needed it, you went to the same community and got it? What if the community
includes those same scoundrels, which wouldn't be any different from our society, Western society. Mm-hmm. So you gave up your savings, then when you needed it, it didn't work.
Could I just add one thing to that, though, John? I don't think it's fair to call the relatives scoundrels necessarily.
Well, these
happen to be, but in African culture in Cameroon, if you had a need and you always went to your relative, and as a Christian, you gave whatever you could to those relatives. Mm-hmm. And if you had 50 aunts and uncles and third cousins who came and said, I need money for such and such, you just wouldn't think of not turning over any available funds to those people. Mm-hmm. So it's just a complete different understanding of who owns the money. Mm-hmm. They didn't see anything wrong with sharing the wealth like that, even though it didn't happen to be theirs.
Here, I want to make two very different types of responses. The first thing that came to my mind was the notion of dependency and how modern Western Christian missions have really been an exercise in creating dependence. And there are a lot of African Christians today who say, we want to keep your missionaries coming because as soon as they stop coming, the funds from overseas stop coming, and we're dependent on those funds. Roland Allen wrote a book in 1912 for which he was eventually excommunicated from the Anglican Church, but he told his concerned children not to worry that someday his writings would be taken more seriously than they were by the Anglican Church in 1912. And today, it's a book that is available in paperback still, you know, more and more in print and starting to be read at seminaries, called Missionary Methods, St. Paul's or Ours. I think, is it in the library here?
Yeah. Spontaneous Explosion of the Church.
And that's his other one that I don't know as well. And he talks about this whole notion of creating dependencies and how Paul's methods were designed to prevent too much of a relationship of dependency. Paul went and spent no longer than 6 months in an area, baptized a few people, and then got out of the way of the workings of the Spirit. So that whatever church took root there wasn't dependent on anybody from the outside, that it was just a relationship between those Christians and the Holy Spirit. Allen says in 1912, his experience of the church in China was that after 100 years, missionaries would, if they left tomorrow, the whole thing would collapse. And so we need to be sensitive, first of all, to the critique that we have created situations of dependency, but also to the recognition that we can't then, recognizing what we've done, just walk away from it, which is what I first thought you were starting to ask, and then realized that your comment was different. The independent churches, there is a great deal of charlatanism, I'll call it that, which operates among the leadership of these churches. There's quite a few leaders of African independent churches whose sense of calling to that position, I think, is pretty severely obscured by the financial promise that seems to go along with being in this position. In other words, it's perpetuating some of the traditions of leadership in Africa, which is that the chief might administer wealth collectively. And you expect that your chief should be one of the most affluent members of your community because it's going to be the chief's responsibility to look after anyone who's hungry. So the chief better be a person of considerable means. And in the independent churches, it's common that when people gather for high religious days, such as Christmas or Good Friday and Easter, that collections are taken for the bishop. And a lot of these leaders are, I think, ripping their people off, making a lot of money off of them. And so there is a problem of what we, with our Western standards, might call misuse of funds. One difference between the two, I think, is that over here, people for 100 years have been coming to terms with that problem. And over here, it's only now in the 1980s that Africans are being given responsibility for administering funds that come from overseas or that are the collections taken from their whole church. And now suddenly there's new issues to be raised for administering church funds as opposed to administering my own monies. I mean, we might, with our Western standards, might want to say to that African Christian whose family comes to him in need that you need to distinguish between what are your private monies and what are your church monies. But then right away we've laid some Western standards of private ownership on them. I mean, you've been, I gather, reading the second the chapter of Wallace's book about injustice, where he talks so much about the church's collective ownership of economic means, you know, the new church, and how they just pooled all their funds. And maybe there's a sense in which people who hang on to that view of property, you know, who's to say that our attitudes are better than theirs? I mean, there's a lot to be said for that notion of collective ownership. But then maybe they need to work out some systems whereby people in the church don't feel like monies which were sent to them overseas have suddenly gone to help out some family member's personal greed. I don't know. The biggest difference between the two, I think, is that here people are struggling within their own communities to work out those norms, and over here it's been so controlled by the outside for so long that now that finally authority is being turned over to indigenous people, they're at a very early stage of working out how are they going to answer these questions, and that's it's kind of a liability.
But within, I think I hear your answer to part of my question, within the small community, they would know how to work that out better than the missionary church would know how to work out this particular matter with a new director of a...
I wouldn't say they know better, but I would say that they've collected more experience at dealing with it. And that, I think that's really how you eventually learn how to deal with it, is by having to go through it and having a lot of painful experiences. I'm dead sure that the kind of example you cite has to happen a good number of times before that Cameroonian church decides how it's going to resolve these problems. But the issue is whether it started happening 100 years ago or started happening in 1982. And I think it started happening in the independent churches 100 years ago, and it's only more recently starting to happen over here. Let's move on to healing, unless there are some more questions about community. I mean, the important thing about community is that there's a tight-knit sense of close community, which is operative there, and which is a very spiritual experience to share and to be part of. And there's another reason why they would want to call themselves spiritual churches. Although the spirit is very strong among the historical churches too. And I'm really building up the one side of Christendom in South Africa and criticizing heavily the other side. It doesn't mean that I think the one is no good and the other is all good. There's a lot of bad and good on both sides of that line. But the one has been grossly overlooked by our Western tradition, and I really, for that reason, I'm going to try and build it up, make it attractive, seduce your interests. Now, the old lady that I want to show you some pictures of in a minute, let me first tell you her story of how she became a minister, because it's reflective of how it says a lot about healing in traditional African culture. And it also says a lot about leadership in the African independent churches and the notion of being called to the ministry. She was, after she got married, her husband decided she was mad. She would periodically experience fits of amafufunyana. That's a Xhosa name for a Xhosa condition. A Western psychiatrist might misdiagnose it as hysteria. It is really more properly the realm of an anthropologist or a traditional African healer. It's a cultural disease that really doesn't have a referent outside of that culture. But it involves a kind of madness, and periodically she would just go mad. And eventually, this got to be such a problem that her husband divorced her. He just said, "Forget it, you know, I can't deal with this." And so when she was divorced, she was now dependent. I mean, she had to look after her own support. And so what she did was to go off to Johannesburg and become a servant in a large, in a white household of many servants. She was the head servant because she has tremendous natural leadership qualities. And she was so good as a head servant. You know, probably there were 6 or 10 servants in this household. And she was so good as an administrator of all the others that her madam and master put up with the fact that periodically she would go mad and be totally unreliable for, you know, maybe a day at a time, maybe a week or two, depending on how she was afflicted by this condition. But all the time, over the years of her madness, she kept looking for help. She kept going and consulting healers, traditional African healers. She, I think it was in the Methodist or Presbyterian church that she'd grown up, and she'd go to those churches and she didn't get healed there. She'd go and consult a diviner and not get healed there. Go and see a traditional Ikbayaha. I don't think witch doctor is a very useful term by Westerners because it connotes so much misunderstanding that I would rather call those people what they call themselves. I'm a kliach. Anyway, she went and saw all these healers and never got satisfaction. Finally, at one point, she consulted a healer from the African Independent Churches, a bishop with well-known, well-reputed healing powers, who said to her, I think God is calling you to be a healer, and you will never be well until you take up this work. Now, there are some very important parallels there. I'm digressing from her experience now to some of the cultural parallels that will be more or less familiar. A less familiar one would be the notion that in traditional African healing systems, the Ikbayaha is not someone who comes from a relatively affluent family and is able to afford medical school and chooses to become a doctor. No way can you choose to become an Ikbayaha. You have to be tapped. You have to be called to that healing ministry. And the way in which you're called is that some existing Ikbayaha who you go to in search of healing at some point says to you, I think the ancestors are calling you to take up this work, to be an Ikbayaha, a healer. And you will never get well until you answer the call, this call. And so the process of getting well then means that you apprentice yourself to the healer, and for a period of a significant period of time, maybe a couple of years, you live at the home of that healer and you learn the techniques of healing, and you are slowly, gradually initiated into the ranks of being a healer. That's traditional African religion. Another more familiar parallel would be the idea that in our own society, you can never become a qualified psychiatrist or psychologist unless you have gone through a psychoanalyst, unless you have gone through a significant experience of psychoanalysis yourself. It's another familiar example of the same phenomenon would be the notion that the best alcoholic therapists are former alcoholics. I mean, that's a well-accepted fact in our society. That the best healers are those who have gone through a severe or profound health crisis of their own and have come out the better for it. And maybe do well for it. I mean, only get healed because of their active involvement in a ministry of other healing. I heard of someone recently whose own experience of dealing with the condition of anorexia was conquered, if you will, by working with other anorexics. So there's a sense in which the kind of calling to this ministry of healing that this woman tells as her story has some very important and parallels in other parts of the world. Man, she takes up the work, is apprenticed to him for a couple of years, and when finally she is initiated into the healing profession, her bishop says to her, now you must go home, go back to the Transkei. She had started off in South Africa, here's Johannesburg up here where she's working as a servant. Her home is here in the Transkei area that I'll talk more about tonight. She moved from the Transkei to King Williamstown to marry her husband. When he divorced her, she went up to Johannesburg to work as a servant. And then from Johannesburg, she was sent back to her home in the Transkei and told, go back there and spread my church. Do your ministry, heal people back there. And in the course of doing that, bring more and more people into my church. That was some 25 years ago, and since that time she's engaged in a ministry of healing. She's traveled different parts of the country, and she has congregations spread around the country now, and is a great Christian healer in her own right. But we'll tell you that on her own she can do nothing. That it's only God's special power granted to her. And sometimes it's there and sometimes it's not, which answers the faith of Christians who come to her in search of healing. But she says without these two things, she can do nothing. Yet over the course of her healing ministry, there has been a coincidence of these two factors. Christians who come to her in the faith that she can help them, and God giving her the strength to answer that faith. But especially in this recent trip, I was really struck by how often she stressed that there must be that faith on the part of her, of the people who come to her. Now, she has established around her, and this was something else that I gained a much stronger sense of on this recent trip than I had ever realized before. We were staying on her compound, which is a piece of ground. I meant to measure it and I didn't, but I would guess it's about at most 40 yards deep and about 20 yards wide, where which is almost full of buildings and one small garden and a little driveway, where from 25 to 60 people live. I've never been able to figure out exactly how many people live there, and anyway, a census would be meaningless since it changes all the time. On any given day, someone can show up who's traveled 200 miles in search of Nomatandazile, the one who prays. In search of the one who prays, because they've heard, I mean, they're suffering, and they've had a vision that she can help them, or they've heard from someone else who was once helped by this person, that if you go and see this lady can pray for you, and you might find what you're looking for in the way of help. Now, when people show up at her place, they might spend a couple of hours there. They might be told that your condition is pretty serious and it's going to take some sustained prayer and you better try and rent a room in the township here. Or they might be told that they can, if they're really severe and if she thinks she can help them, she might say, okay, there's a space over there where you can sleep in, you know, in one of these huts. And suddenly the population of her compound has grown by another. We'd go around and ask her. She has no surviving children of her own. Yet she is called Granny or Umama by everyone on the compound. And it includes children from an infant age all the way up to adults. And you start asking questions about the people who stay there, and virtually every single one of them will tell you that at one point they were brought here as a child by their parents or as an adult by their husband who was exasperated with what to do with them. It's largely women on this compound. But men also get healed there. The women are the ones who stay. And they'll tell you that they arrived in a very sick state. And that in the course of staying there, they found health, and also, by the way, found a community which they felt a part of. And after they got healed, many of them go on and, you know, go back to their homes and their families and carry on their life, but a lot of them stay. And for example, there was one young girl about, I suppose she's about 10 or 12 years old, whose parents a year ago brought her and said, you know, we can do nothing with this child. She's just crazy. And we ask you to please pray for her. And so the old lady said, okay, I'll take her in and I'll feed her and I'll clothe her and I'll see that she gets schooling and she can join my community here. And after about 6 months, the child was okay. She was well. And then the mother, the original mother, came and said, I'm so grateful that you have brought life to this child. I give this child to you. And sometimes that's a genuine feeling of gratitude that new life has been given to the child, and it's an actual giving of a resource to the old lady. Sometimes it's a recognition that a fear that if the child leaves this community, the child might go mad again, and that it's in the best interest of the child to stay there longer. And some adult women come, and the old lady says to them, I think God is calling you to be a healer, and you will never be well until you take up this work. And then they apprentice themselves to the old lady, and they become her assistants, and to the point now where she, at her age of about 70 years of age, will, she doesn't directly treat many of the people who show up there anymore. I asked her once, I said, how do you decide who to treat and who to let one of your assistants treat? And she says, well, it depends on which one of us is expecting them. And I said, well, you know what I mean? I couldn't imagine that people made appointments to come and see their doctor in this type of a situation. And she said to me, she explained it to me, but it didn't really sink in until at a later stage I experienced what she meant. One day she was talking about how she didn't feel well, and I said, well, what's wrong? Didn't you sleep well last night? And she said, no, I slept all right, but I just don't feel well. And then a minute later she said, I think we're gonna get visitors. And that didn't mean anything to me. About an hour or two later, a woman showed up who nobody on this compound had ever seen before. She was from far place, you know, had come a couple hundred miles. And she had troubles. And she sat and told her troubles and her problems and her sickness to the old lady. The old lady sat down immediately and dealt with her, and then we prayed for her, and the old lady gave her some water, some holy water that had been prayed for to strengthen her on her way, and off she went. And a few hours later that afternoon, the old lady came back to me and said, oh, I feel much better now. And I said, well, did you have a nap? Because I still figured her sickness was related to not sleeping well. And she said, no. She laughed and she said, no, don't you remember? I told you that I thought we were going to get visitors. And she said, this is what I mean when I say that we expect someone who's coming in search of healing. And this is classic African tradition. And it happens in much of the third world, that the healers are people with a sensitivity so profound to those who come to them in search of healing that they actually will experience the symptoms of their patient in advance of the arrival of the patient. Now, I have no way in terms of Western material thinking of understanding how that takes place, but I've seen it happen. And I know it's happened, and it'll often be the case that when a new patient shows up on that old lady's compound, the various healers will huddle in the kitchen and they'll decide which one of them was expecting this new patient. You know, which one of them was actually feeling ill in a way that was a forewarning to them that there was someone coming in need of their sympathy. One more quick story about healing, which gets at the issue of culture and faith. And then I want to show you some slides to give you some visual images of who these people are. The old lady's treatments for healing are basically, you know, there's a lot of similarity from one patient to another. There's a lot of laying on of hands and prayer and individual counseling, which is always different. But the physical techniques are often the same. And they involve a lot of, you know, what we might call purification things. You know, you might... the first thing that will always happen is that your water will be boiled, and you'll go into the treatment hut and sit in one of these big metal wash tubs. You know, if they had bathtubs, I'm sure that would be preferable, but they don't. You sit in one of these wet metal wash tubs on a couple of 2x4s, and they pour some boiling water on the floor of the tub with some ammonia maybe in it, and then pile blankets over you. You know, we might call it a steam bath of sorts. It's a rudimentary form of a steam bath. And then lay on hands and pray and tell you to say the Lord's Prayer in English once and in Sesotho once and in Xhosa once and the Apostles' Creed and so forth and so on. So a lot of kind of purification type things. You'd get an enema, you'd be given a solution to drink which would cause you to vomit. You'd inhale a solution which would clear your head and all different kinds of stuff like that. But the old lady says there are cases where people really don't seem to be making much progress. You know, they come for the treatments every morning and every night for a week or so, and they're just not making much progress. And then she will say to them, I think you better bring a goat to my place and let me slaughter it for you. Bear in mind what the historical church Christians have said about how these independent church people are guilty of practicing heathen traditions by way of sacrificing animals. The traditional Kirche might say to you that after the birth of your last son, you neglected to slaughter a sheep to give thanks to the ancestors, and now the ancestors are angry and they've withdrawn their protection of evil spirits from you, and with the result that the evil spirits have come and now you've angered the ancestors and you're in a big mess, and really to get out of it, you better bring a goat to my place, me, the Klecha, who knows how to communicate with the ancestors, and let me slaughter that goat for you in the way the ancestors like, and in that manner you can hope to pacify the ancestors, to win back their good graces, and then everything will be right again. The old lady says to her patient, I think you better bring a goat to my place next week and let me slaughter it for you. right away, all the people in the historical churches, you know, think that this is proof that she's a heathen. But she says that she slaughters that goat with a difference from the way the Akleha would do it. Now, of course, a white missionary who is not too familiar with the way the Akleha would do it might not catch some of the differences between how the Akleha slaughters that goat and how she slaughters the goat. For example, the Akleha will never let even a drop of the blood of that animal fall to the ground. If it does, the whole thing is wasted and you have to start over, because for the blood is a special part of the ritual, and it's an abomination in the eyes of the ancestors to let that precious blood fall to the ground. She collects, the old lady collects the blood of that animal, and in one dramatic act of sacrilege, as far as traditional African customs are concerned, she spills the blood on the ground. And as she does so, she says to her patient, "Look, you and I are Christians. And as Christians, we have no need for this part of our traditional African custom, because we have already been saved by Christ's blood, which was spilt for us." Now, to my way of thinking, that's an example of taking a traditional custom and altering it in such a way that you communicate some of the Christian message. And I don't personally have any problems with that. But as a Westerner who was not schooled in the way the traditional African Ekwekas do it and how an African independent church minister does it, I might, you know, out of the confusion of my faith and culture, not be able to see here an alteration of a Christianization of African culture, with the result that I would tend to negatively judge that which in fact is the way to Christ for a lot of people. Let's look at a few slides and some examples, some visual images of who these people are.
You want to pull down the tube if you can.
I have to apologize to you in very much regret that I forgot to bring with me something that I usually travel with, and that's the tape of some music from the African Independent Church. No, those are Namibian freedom songs.
Oh, okay.
And I do have a copy of that with me. But the music from the independent churches is very different. And it's got a real vibrancy to it. And you're going to see pictures of these people singing here. And it'll pain me that I didn't bring that tape along with me so that you could hear and see them.
It would be pain you enough that we should go up and get our Cameroonians.
Well, yeah. It would pain me to think I had sent you out in the cold to do that. These are... I can't go backwards on this machine. That was just a gathering of some of the people, and you get a feel for their uniforms. There's other pictures later. This was when I stayed with them 3 weeks ago. I'm sorry, 5 years ago, I stayed for 3 weeks with them, and I had painted a couple of signs. These people are not recognized by the government because they're not recognized by white Christians as being legitimate Christians. Therefore, they cannot get a separate plot of land upon which to build a church. Therefore, their churches operate in the homes of the church minister, and the way by which they identify a given compound as being of a church is by putting up some kind of a sign. Now, most of the signs are very rudimentary, and I had painted some signs for them a couple years ago. Now the old lady was changing the name of her church for some political reasons that maybe we can go into more this evening. And she wanted me to paint her a new sign. So while Barbara and I were there, we did this sign for her with the Xhosa Bible passage, "Uti u Yezu, imi kondis oke ea kulandele, kulandelana nabo, bakilo bako liweo, nansi egamini lambaya kukupa idar idimo." Jesus said, it's Mark 16:17. Jesus said, "Believers will have the power to cast out demons in my name." And as this is a place where people come in search of healing, both what we would call physical healing and also what we would call psychological healing, Africans, of course, wouldn't distinguish. They believe in holistic healing. There's a gathering of her congregation with Barbara and I on the extreme left there. I had committed the ghastly mistake of not taking my sport coat with me. I thought, well, you know, it's hot in Africa. I don't want to drag my sport coat all the way over there. So I had arrived without a sport coat. which was an insult to them, that a man, especially someone that they considered a minister, would arrive in a church without a proper attire. So they took one Sunday shortly after I arrived and cloaked me in a robe like the rest of the bishops have. There's the old lady in her dress, carrying it's a kind of a spear, which is a traditional symbol there. And she's also got a bell. When the chanting is going on and she wants it to stop, she rings her bell and then the chanting comes to the stop. Chanting is the basic rubric of the worship service. It occurs in between everything else. You know, if you're gonna preach a sermon, you'll chant beforehand and you'll chant afterward. And she has a tremendously charismatic way of moving from the sermon into the chant. And she'll be preaching away very powerfully and then all of a sudden go into the first line of the song. And then the whole congregation will pick up on that song. It's really a beautiful experience. Here's the Sunday school choir walking around, beating their cymbals and singing before the service begins, as just kind of a message to everyone on the compound and to people, anyone within earshot, that church is about ready to begin. And then they line up in front of the door to the chapel. That's that building that we're looking at there on the right, on the left-hand side is a one-room chapel where her church meets, and on the right-hand side is a two-room apartment where we stay. But the children's choir would form a little line here, and you would walk into the church with them chanting away. There we are inside the chapel building.
Is it typical of most independent churches that the people all have the same clothes?
Yeah, uniforms are a very important part, and are one of the ways by which independent churches have an identity other than historical churches. If, to the extent that historical church people would have a dress code, it would be very much sport coats and dark sport coats and ties and dark dresses, black in some cases. But in the independent churches, they wear these uniforms, and you can actually, there are different types of independent churches. There are the Zionist, who we'll see some examples of in a moment. There are the apostolic, of which this is a variety, and then there are the Ethiopian. And those are just, it's like a spectrum of how African versus Western are they. This is a middle type group.
I wore hose to church in Cameroon, and I was told by about three or four missionaries that that was probably the first time in the history of African churches that anyone had come in hose. That's really embarrassing.
Do they wear the clothes during the week? Or is this just a Sunday?
No, this is a Sunday go to meet in uniform.
Okay. Does each congregation then have its own uniform?
Yep. And so it's part of their identity. And on Sunday in Soweto, or even in Johannesburg, you see all these people walking around with all these brightly colored uniforms.
What's identifying? Is it the banner, the ribbon across the chest?
No, it would be the totality of the uniform. And you know, there'd be all different kinds of parts to it. The lace that they wear around their shoulders, and the banner is one thing, and the hat is another thing, and the color of the garbage, you know, this tremendous variety. I mean, there are some 4,000 of these churches in South Africa, and you know, in poor rural areas, they might just wear ragged white sheets sewn into garments. But in, you know, this is more of a middle class church, and so they have. You see the pictures and symbols and stuff on the walls, whatever that, they can get their hands on.
Is that a man with a clerical collar?
Yes.
Okay. Who is he?
That's one of the ministers. In a moment you'll see some other four ministers. And the old lady would kind of got a kick out of the fact that whenever I came to visit her and stay at her place, then a number of other ministers from surrounding churches tend to come and visit her churches.
Oh, I see.
And she said, "Where are these people when you're not around? We never see them." She does speak English. Most of the people on her compound did not.
How old is she?
She's not exactly sure, but getting close to 70. But boy, when you see her preach, you would think she was 25 years old. I mean, she just gets whipped up. She's this huge woman, you know, about 5 foot tall, but just a huge woman in weight. And but when you see her just start spitting out her preaching, it's unbelievable the vigor. The vitality that she gets going. The chanting always takes place with the clapping of hands. So that's why you see people clapping their hands here, rhythm and chanting away. And it's really a very powerful, infectious experience of worship to be caught up in that. And it's literally, well, it's a technique of ecstasy, and you get high from it if you chant, clapping your hands like that in a small room for hours on end.
What do they chant?
Jerusalem, Ikhayalam, Jerusalem, my home, Olidi Tandayo, that I love so much. Well, Fezwani, come with me, brothers and sisters, let's go to Jerusalem. But they would be quick to add that the words are not so important as the music. It's only Westerners with their orientation toward rationality who want to pay so much attention to the words. Here's some of the ministers who had gathered from different churches. Some of them real characters. There's the wife of the bishop of this church. The old lady is by far and away the head of her church, although she will always tell you that it's her bishop. It's Chuba, her bishop, who is the head of the church. And that's because she doesn't feel comfortable with her church being headed by a woman. And on the sign that she had me paint for her, she refused to let me put her name. I had to put the name of her bishop down there because she was afraid that some people would not feel comfortable in a church that didn't have a male leader. And this is the wife of the bishop preaching at one point. Some women, I think this was during the administered, while the sacrament of Holy Communion was being administered. And these women were kneeled there while the rest of the congregation sang in the background.
Did you see that woman's hand?
Yeah. I can't go backwards. Up, I just blew it. Trying to do it.
Let me see
if
on the machine you're
okay. Can you back up about three or four slides?
Yeah.
Do you have any ideas as to why the...
There we go. Okay.
That's good.
Oh, I blew it again. I'm sorry.
What was that one?
Oh, yeah. That woman is a... she was albino. Wasn't a pure albino. I mean, she... You know, the pigmentation of her skin in some cases was there and in other cases wasn't. We don't tend to notice albinos in our own culture so much because they don't stand out as much as they do among a race of darker, you know, skinned people.
Is she treated the same as everyone else?
I don't know. You know, I mean, I don't know her well enough to know if she's ever experienced any discrimination of any sort because of her skin color, but there certainly wasn't, you know, in the groups that I was with her in, there wasn't any differentiation of her skin condition made. That's just pouring pictures out of focus. I think Barbara must have taken this.
Any ideas as to why the congregation was mostly women?
Well, there are some theories. First of all, in the rural reservation areas, about which I'll be saying a lot more tonight, there is a noticeable absence of men because there's no jobs, and so the men are expected to be migrant laborers, and so there just aren't many men around. But in this congregation, there were some men, but they were over... I was standing on the side of the room with the men, so when I took pictures, I tended to see women through my lens rather than moving over to the other side of the room and photographing men. But there was definitely a preponderance of women. And that might be the population factor, the fact that there are more women around. It might be related, it certainly would be related to some degree to the fact that this was a church where a woman, even though she didn't claim to be titularly the head of it, she was definitely in charge. And there'd be, you know, there are some men that just found that unacceptable.
David?
Yes.
I take it that the men and the women sat in separate places during the worship service?
On different sides of the room. Mm-hmm. Now here, I said that her church represents an example of a kind of middle level church. This would be a more, what we might call a more radical, a more African style of Christianity. One night we went and worshiped with these people who are also great friends of mine. This is the bishop of that church, who I would very much, while I was there, I really developed a sense of how important it would be sometimes to bring this man and the old lady to this country for a little tour. Because I'm convinced that between the two of them, we could do a little chanting that I could never get you to do. This guy is a very charismatic, powerful leader. By day, he is a foreman at a milling company. But by night, he is the leader, the bishop of a denomination that has congregations spread around South Africa. And he was all set to go on the road with me. He expected me to be there at least 6 months, and he had bought a car while I was gone, and we were going to set out, and he was going to take me around to visit his congregations, figuring that this would be good way to build up his churches. And he couldn't understand when I told him that, well, I didn't think that'd be possible, for one, because I didn't get a visa to South Africa, and he couldn't understand why I wouldn't get a visa to South Africa. Me, a holy man. But we went and worshipped with him. Some of these are badly out of focus. I took this picture, not but it was taken at night in a dark room, and if you ever tried to focus a camera in the dark, it's impossible.
What's in his hand?
That's a little shaker. It's a rattle. So, you know, it's got some beans inside of a little can, and it just, as you shake it, it's like a baby rattle, you know, and he's doing that as he's chanting, people are clapping, and he's making this rattling sound. And then the Bible in his other hand, of course. Now, the Zionist churches, of which this is an example, tend to be more colorful and more elaborate in the symbolism on their uniform. And you'll find, you know, stars and crosses and half moons and this kind of thing on the garments of these people. Instead of meeting in a more modern type, square building, which the old lady did, this being a lower class phenomenon, they're meeting in a round mud brick hut with a cone-shaped thatched roof. The old lady didn't tend to use drums, except in some secret services. But on a public Sunday morning service, she was a little nervous about using drums. The Zionist churches do use drums. And we were a small crowd this night because it was a hastily called service. But you put on a Sunday morning 60 or 70 people in this small hut, and it's dark in there and hot and stuffy, and you start beating a drum, and then you start dancing around in a circle. And really, it's a powerful experience. I wish we had the music. While we were there, they were receiving us as their guests, and they had heard that the old ladies' church had given a dress to Barbara, and so they had collected some monies, and here they are showing the dress which they've given her, and they instructed the women to take her out and put this dress on her right away, which they did, and they were so pleased to see how she looked in the dress that they had given her. And then one of them gave Barbara this stick. You see the stick she's holding in her right hand there. And she started dancing with it, and they liked the way she used it so much that they gave it to her on the spot. And this was a holy stick of, you know, really elaborate carving, although you can't see it here. We're a little nervous at the moment because we sent three packages from the Transkei. Two of them have arrived, but the ones with sticks have not. Hoping they will. So, those are some images.
Oh, she looked like she was enjoying it.
Yeah, she did. Barbara did not grow up in the Lutheran Church as I did, and so her orientation to Christianity is not nearly is not like mine. And the idea of being at the old lady's house, where, you know, we were just across the wall from where they gathered for prayers at 5 o'clock every morning, and you know we would hear them, and then they would pray a couple of times during the day, and we had to go to prayers every night, and she got a little sick of that. But the one night we went over here, she found this so, she really enjoyed this experience because it was a much different style of Christianity. Well, I want to close by saying a little bit about my own theology of mission. And I suppose I could have spent more time on this, except I get so excited about the independent churches, I want to talk about that. But I want to tell you how I introduced myself to them, as a way also of introducing myself here this week and what I do. Always when I entered one of their churches, it was very unusual for a white person to be found in those churches. For the most part, whites don't consider them to be Christian, and if a white comes to one of these churches, it's usually to tell these people how they should convert to true Christianity. But in a society of white supremacy, like Southern Africa, blacks don't refuse entrance to whites, so I would come in, and they would quickly stop their chanting, and the bishop would acknowledge my presence and turn it over to me for a word. And I want to share with you now the same thing that I used to share in that situation, a way of introducing myself and my sense of Christian mission. I said, when God called me to be a minister to my people, I followed the custom in my country and I went to the university to study. But I went with a clear sense that not all was well within my church. Because as I looked around, many of my friends had lost interest in participating in the worship life of a congregation. And so they didn't go to church anymore. And I considered this a sign of ill health on the part of my churches, that we weren't attracting people to worship life anymore. In fact, church attendance is falling off. And so when I went to the university to study, it was with this sense that not all was well within my church, and I quickly learned that there are really two sides to God's message. I felt called to minister to this weakness of my church, and in the course of studying, I learned that there's a difference between the message of the Word and the message of the Spirit. And as I looked at my church, I felt maybe we had been more richly blessed with an understanding of the message of God's Word than we had been with an understanding of the message of God's Spirit. What I didn't say to them, but I will say to you, since you're, in Western terms, a better educated audience, is that I think there's a scientific basis for this Word and Spirit theology. Psychologists are telling us that there are really two sides to our brain. The one hemisphere of the brain is where logical, mathematical, reason-type mental life is centered. And on the other side of our brain is where aesthetic, musical, artistic mental life is centered. And I have the notion that those are really two types of God's message. The way we experience God through one sphere of our brain or the other. And anthropologists tell us that it appears certain cultures emphasize the development of one sphere of the brain more than they do the other sphere of the brain. If that's the case, there's no question which sphere of the brain Western culture has emphasized. And that's the rational side. And likewise, there's no question which sphere of the brain African culture has emphasized. So as I went back to my studies, I looked for a way in which I might better train myself in an understanding of the message of God's Spirit so as to more effectively minister to my people, whom have been richly blessed with an understanding of the message of God's Word, i.e. the fact that my young friends who had lost interest in attending church still would tell me logically what they believe. They had just lost interest in the spiritual life of a worshiping community. And in the course of my studies, I learned that there was a whole phenomenon of Christianity out there in the world which was richly blessed in its understanding of the message of God's Spirit, although somewhat more lacking in its understanding of the message of God's Word. No seminaries to offer Bible lectures, to give ministers a sense of the rational theology and rational biblical history that we're so familiar with. Richly blessed in an understanding of the message of God's Spirit. Keep in mind what I said about the spirit of community and the spirit of healing, which is so alive and well in those churches, and which is really the heritage of the earliest Christian communities, though somewhat more lacking on the other side. And so I prayed that God would give me some opportunity to go and see these African independent churches, that I might learn more from them about the message of God's Spirit. And as you see me standing in front of you today, you know that prayer has been answered. And that's how I introduced myself when I went to an independent church congregation. Immediately, someone would follow up by saying, well, we see that you have not come to convert us to your style of Christianity. And this is very unusual. Most of the whites that we've ever met who have come to these churches, of which there haven't been too many, have come to convert us to their style. And we see that that's not what you're about. You've come to learn from us. So we trust you. And we want to know, will you set up some Bible lectures for our ministers? Because you know stuff about the Bible that we want to get. And there was some deep irony in this. Because the very thing that people in the historical churches are always trying to get at the independent churches to do, to teach them the word, is an experience denied to those people and made available to me because I had come saying, you have something that I need. My church is weak in a way that your church is strong. And the opportunity to share, which was not my agenda in going, was given to me because I had come with a different agenda. And that symbolizes for me that the difference between the type of mission to which I think we're called by God and the type of mission that we've been trying to carry out for the last couple of hundred years, Westerners now. Instead of trying to duplicate our understanding of the Christian faith, which is really a type of imperialism, saying we have it and we want to give it to everybody else, and which is still the basic rationale underlying all of Western cultures going out to the world, whether it be in the economic sphere, multinationals who go to give these people, but at the same time are really enriching themselves, or whether it be missionaries who go out to take the gospel to Africa, which is really a way of affirming our own identity. Maybe there's a sense in which we, Western Christians, have been most shortchanged by that style of Christian ministry, because the Spirit has worked in spite of the way we tried to introduce the gospel. And Christianity is strong and vibrant in Africa today, in spite of the techniques by which we brought it. But I wouldn't say that the Western Church is any more aware of the gifts of God's Spirit out there in the world today than it is before it ever started sending missionaries out. And that's why I say maybe there's a sense in which our limited view of Christian mission has shortchanged us. I would argue that we need to take develop a theology of mission which says that the opportunity for mission is an opportunity to encounter, and that encounter is a two-way street. You meet someone who has just as much to offer you as you have to offer them. And the best way, especially for culturally chauvinistic Westerners, to find out what we can learn from other people is first not to consider leaving this society until we have a pretty solid critique of ourselves, i.e. knowing what we need. And secondly, not to leave the society until we have a pretty strong conviction that over there, out there where we're going, are people who are strong in the way that we're weak. And then go out with a clear sense that we're going to see what these people can offer us. And if we have anything to give, we don't need to worry about that being in the front of our minds. Because anything that we have worth giving will be taken from us. It doesn't have to be given to people. It'll be taken from us by those who see in us a value for themselves. So I would plead with you, and I think we are all missionaries, and I don't think that this message is so important to make at the mission boards in Minneapolis and New York and St. Louis as it is in the church among us, that we would get over this Western hang-up of seeing what we have to offer the world and instead go out in search of what the world has to offer us, what in fact the diversity of God's creation makes available to us through the one body that's a lot bigger than the Lutheran Church in the United States of America. I think this theology of encounter can be an antidote for what I call the guilty seeking justice. You know, there's a sense in which, as we read Wallace's chapter on injustice, you know, he talks about the danger of us getting guilty, and so much of U.S. Response to the Vietnam War or to Southern Africa today or to the Middle East is really, you can analyze it in terms of our being guilty and our trying to make some response out of our guilt. That's a negative basis. And I don't think that's what God calls us into one family for, to feel guilty about how we've treated our brothers and sisters. God gives us a diverse order of creation that we may be enriched through the oneness. And if that's our focus, not to make right our sins of the past, but rather to claim for ourselves the gifts of God's promise to us, then I think it becomes a much more positive motivation. And instead of always feeling tired from having to go to another, you know, having to give more money for hunger, face the depressing situation of the third world once again. Instead of that kind of negative motivation, we'll find drawn to something that's very exciting. Maybe that should have been two presentations, and probably we'll do more on some of the theology of encounter on Wednesday, when we talk about the hope of Christ for our lives. And for this morning, we ought to just rest on some of my having the chance to share my enthusiasm about what will soon be the center of the Christian church and about what has a lot to offer us, especially in terms of faith healing community. So,
thank you.